Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. Today we've got a very special guest for you all. We are joined by Dr. Tyler Panzner. How are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. Thank you so much for having me on.
No problem. Thank you for coming on. So Dr. Tyler Panzner is a PhD in pharmacology from Stony Brook University. And you also have a undergraduate from South Florida in cell biology.
Correct.
Sweet.
Yep.
And you're currently a holistic genetic coach. Is that how you describe yourself?
Yeah, holistic genetic health optimization. That's kind of the way that I've termed it. And I think it's definitely going to revolutionize not only the health and wellness, health optimization, but I think it'll also eventually be used in the medical sphere to help prevent and reverse chronic diseases.
That is awesome. So how would you differentiate that between personalized genomics? Or is that?
Yeah, so good question. So good example I like to give, I used to work for a personalized genomics company, and where the space is at now for just overall conventional medicine, they do personalizing cancer treatments. So they'll sequence the cancer cell DNA and figure out what drug is the best. They'll sequence your DNA and see your risk for certain cancers. Like you might've heard, like the BRCA gene mutation is really common with breast cancer. And they also do like carrier screening. Let's say you and your significant other want to have a kid. They will sequence both of you. Maybe there's, 25, 50% chance of some severe genetic defect. And they can actually do that in utero as well. So when the mother's pregnant, they can get amniotic fluid and tell the difference between the fetus DNA and the mother. And then they could sequence that as well in case there's any genetic defects early on in pregnancy. So that's kind of where, and they're starting to do some stuff based on your DNA, what mental health mood disorder medications are best for you. But I'm kind of taking that technology and putting it in the holistic context. I left that company and I wanted to do my own thing where it's giving your cells what they need. Like, why are we sequencing cancer cell DNA to figure out what drug works? And we're not sequencing our regular healthy cells and figure out what nutrients they need. Why is all the focus on reactive after the fact of all these things? So basically figuring out exactly based on the genetic mutations, what your cells have a higher requirement for. So even if you're eating a healthy diet and the right daily value percentages, you may need a lot more than that in order to compensate for these mutations. So in a nutshell, figuring out what nutrients your cells require more of, give them that. What certain intermediate forms of things based on pathways, maybe you convert A to B fine, but B to C not very well. And C doesn't exist in nature naturally. Mm-hmm. So you have to take that specific C supplement. And any pathways that may be overactive, inflammatory pathways, and try to specifically inhibit them, utilizing natural treatments first. And I think that you can get a lot done by taking that approach first and foremost before you start any additional types of protocols or things. Because I think the reason why a lot of people get sick, those mutations over time lead to cellular dysfunction, cellular imbalancing. And that's what I think leads to poor health and disease.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So how do you define personalized medicine?
So personalized medicine would be essentially just that. So based on your DNA, your blood work, doesn't necessarily have to be just DNA, but personalizing what your treatment is. So five people come in with depression, and all five of them, unless ironically, they're all extremely genetically similar, but then there's also like mineral contents, toxic load. Someone may have an infection that's contributing to their depression. So they would have to be treated for that as well, while other people could just have a bunch of serotonin receptor mutations or something like that. So I would say in a nutshell, custom tailoring your care, your healthcare, based on your unique situation. And that absolutely includes the genetic makeup.
So I just want to give the listeners a little introduction to genetics, and please stop me wherever. If you see me going haywire or anything. So basically everyone has one set of chromosomes that they get half from their mom, half from their dad, more or less. But a lot of people don't really understand how it goes further. So your genes are basically a little language where they have four letters, A, T, C, and G, which are four letters of the code. And I would like to imagine your genes like a strip of an old movie film, like those old projectors where it's just one after the other.
It's a great way of putting it. I like that analogy.
And as you scroll down, you've got these millions of letters, one after the other in a chain, and you put enough together and you get the amino acid. If you put three together, specifically an amino acid, which are the building blocks of proteins, put enough of these together, you get a full film or a protein. And Proteins, if you don't know, are like the blue collar workers of the body. They do pretty much everything from digestion, neurotransmitters, all the good stuff. And if you were, so if we were, me and you were to compare movie scripts, they would probably look like 99.9% identical almost, right? It's like very, and then, but the few difference in these letters, which you probably wouldn't even see if you're looking at it with your naked eye, is like huge differences. And that changes basically the whole film or how the proteins are shaped and, or the machinery, if you want to think about it that way, and how these machinery, these shapes of the proteins are changed, it determines how they function. So like you may have a fast functioning protein, I have a slow or in the middle. And do you want to like kind of give an example of that?
Yeah, definitely. So first off, that was really good at explaining on your job, on your point. So good job with that. Good example I like to give is this gene called the COMT gene. This is what breaks down dopamine and adrenaline after your brain releases it. And I have a double mutation, both copies. So I'm homozygous mutation for it to work slower. Mm-hmm. So I break down adrenaline and dopamine four times slower than someone that doesn't have those mutations. So that's, you know, just if you think about it, high dopamine, high adrenaline, you know, you could think intuitively, what would that present like? And then if you look at all the literature, it's linked to things. The COMT also breaks down estrogen as well. So it's linked to things like estrogen dominance, higher levels of estrogen, higher levels of adrenaline, dopamine. So I've always been very outgoing, very high energy, very type A personality. The thing is, when I get stressed, I release that more adrenaline and I can't break that down. So it's a double-edged sword. When I'm calm, cool, collected, more alert, higher IQ, higher cognition, you know, more alert overall. But when I get stressed, I really can get overwhelmed and kind of not really be able to catch my thoughts and kind of fizzle out. Obviously, the genes aren't everything. I never want to be that guy saying, you know, take my magic pills, the genes are everything. Of course not. You know, you can do a lot of work on your brain. I'm sure we'll get into epigenetics as well, and learning your body, changing your epigenetics to better deal with that stress. My stress threshold will always be lower than the average person. Like I'll... Yeah, it's a lower stress threshold, but now supplements are not. Supplements have helped a lot, but also just learning my body and learning, you know, this is just an emotion that's going to pass. Mm-hmm. It's not the actual reality. So practicing mindfulness has also helped me a lot with that. And, you know, don't get it twisted. I still get overwhelmed sometimes. You know, this week has been a pretty stressful week for me overall. You know, have my wife, thank God, you know, talk me off a ledge sometimes. It's all going to be good. It's all going to be fine. And luckily, she doesn't have this mutation. So she breaks down adrenaline, dopamine normally. So I think it works out good because it could be a downward spiral if we both fizzle out due to stress. So I can kind of help get her going sometimes when she, you know, can get stalled sometimes. I need a little motivation and stuff. But on the flip side, when I get overstressed, you know, she can kind of be the safety net, if you will.
So one of the most interesting things I've heard you say, and I took a little bit of genetics in school, but you kind of like relit my interest in it. So you have, you can either be homozygous or heterozygous for genes. Homozygous means you have the same two copies. You said in a podcast with Pedro, I think, that basically like you have a, like say a 50-50 chance of which gene gets activated. Can you go into that?
Yeah. So when it's deciding when you're forming the egg and sperm, it basically is a 50-50 random shot. I know. Do you remember those Punnett squares? You drew the squares, like the big T, little T. That's, some gene like that is pretty much how it works. So it's a 50-50 shot, and there's no real, to my knowledge, there's no real explanation like beyond that, how which one gets picked. Then you also have the aspect of, you know, which egg actually comes down during ovulation. And then, you know, it's different with the sperm versus the egg. The egg, one just comes down, sometimes two, you know, like fraternal twins and stuff, but pretty much one comes down versus the sperm. I don't even know how many, you know, millions and millions there are for that. So that's, you know, and I've always thought about too, the set of chromosomes that the sperm gets, how does that influence how well the sperm perform? So like the genetics of the sperm, we do know the epigenetics of the sperm definitely matter. Like using drugs, marijuana, alcohol, they can affect the epigenetics of the sperm. And then that offspring could have higher risks for certain types of mood disorders, anxiety. I'm not aware of any studies doing that with psychedelics. I've always wondered, could that be, they have a lot of beneficial effects on the psyche, on neurology, on immunology, inflammation. And I wonder if, you know, anyone out there, I'm not saying, you know, go tripping balls where you're trying to conceive or anything like that. But, you know, I wonder if that could alter it as well. So overall, the sperm itself, the set of chromosomes it gets, could that make it work better or worse? You're kind of like selecting for that. That's kind of always been in my head. But yeah, back to your question. Yeah, it's pretty much like a 50-50 shot at which one you get. And then it's a random assortment of which sperm actually ends up getting to the egg.
Mm-hmm. So, but let's say you have you're heterozygous for the COMT mutation. So let's say you have, I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, how this works. Let's say you have one copy of the fast working COMT protein, one copy of the slow. Well, maybe I misunderstood, but like it's, is there like a way like your body chooses which one gets activated, which gene gets expressed?
Okay. So you're saying if you have it, which one gets expressed?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Yeah. No worries. So it comes down to something called biallelic expression. And for simplicity's sake, usually 50-50 being expressed, mm-hmm. but we do know that's not the case for all genes, but we don't have, no one's done a study on all these different genes to see what percentage is expressed. And the epigenetics also changes based on what type of cell it is. Because if all the cells have the same DNA, how do you have a brain cell versus a skin cell? They're radically, radically different. Mm-hmm. And they come from stem cells or the initial cells during development that turn into everything else. But all of that is epigenetics at work there. Mm-hmm. All the DNA is the same. It's just which genes are being expressed to rearrange the cytoskeleton of the cell to make it long and stringy like a neuron, or it could be like small and compact. That's definitely a loaded question, because then there's also things like that are called like somatic mosaicism, where you could have different subpopulations of cells. You can have different cells in your liver, let's say, that have different clusters of epigenetic, like subpopulations of cells. So even there could be a subtype of, the liver cells can have different subpopulations that all behave somewhat a little bit differently. That's actually what tumors are like. Cancer cells are a whole bunch of different subpopulations. But somatic mosaicism is something where that can kind of happen in our own cells as well. But yeah, just for simplicity's sake, that's a huge can of worms, saying that it's roughly 50-50. Because that's what a lot of studies do show. Some people show that heterozygosity, so having mixed fast and slow for certain genes, you need both to really have that negative effect. But that's only a few genes here and there versus the vast array that I look at for my clients. So just for simplicity's sake, and usually too, everything that I'm doing, I'm matching it up to a symptom. I'm rarely just, I have foundational mutations I look at, but I'm rarely just saying, oh, you're not depressed at all. You have no sleep issues. I'm not really going to look too much into the serotonin system. So I kind of, the genes I look at kind of ebbs and flows with the person based on what the ailments are. Because if you just look at a whole slew of genes for everyone, it's hard to be kind of specific. And that's why I kind of call what I do hyper-personalized. Also figuring out what supplements don't agree with you or foods don't agree with you. So many of my clients come to me taking the wrong supplements, making their sleep worse, making their stress worse, making their gut inflammation worse, making their hair fall out because they're taking natural supplements that don't agree. It may fix one thing, but three other things may be going wrong. But they only advertise it for that one thing. And that's what all these practitioners and, you know, influencers know about. But there's multiple mechanisms to any supplement.
And that brings up a great question that I wanted to hear your perspective on. Why do you view everything as a drug?
Yeah, I mean, by definition, I'm pretty sure a drug is any substance that alters the physiology or psychology of an organism, by definition. So if you're really, obviously there's little, some people say, they mentioned pharmaceutical in front of that, but there's definitely definitions out there that are literally that fairly verbatim. So to me, you take magnesium, magnesium calms you down, helps you sleep better. That's been rigorously proven in clinical trials, all these different studies marketed for that for decades. So by definition, that's considered a drug. Now, would I say like, yeah, magnesium's it's one of those things that I consider them in my head because I think they're all equally important. I've seen people's lives be changed for the better taking pharmaceutical medications. There's a time and place. I just think they're horrifically overutilized way too quickly. I've also seen people, like I just mentioned, really fuck up their health and their life by taking the wrong natural supplements. So I say that as a way to tell people that it's not like natural is always good, synthetic's always bad. Like, I don't care natural or synthetic. All I care about is the molecular structure and how that interacts with your cells pharmacology-wise. Like, I don't care what the name is, where it came from, you know, any of that stuff. All that matters is what pathways does it activate? Does it block? And can your body afford to activate those specific pathways and block those other pathways?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it, because everything has a drug-like effect, at least in some aspect. Yep. Like, even like the food you eat, like what I like to say is like the food has a drug-like effect, but the drugs, like, you know, I wouldn't consider like maybe, I mean, carbs, you could even consider having like a drug-like effect, but like the, you know, the polyphenols, like these things are in such a small dose in the foods that like, if you were to take a huge dose of it, it would be like taking a pharmaceutical probably.
Oh, absolutely. And polyphenols, one of the things, pretty much all polyphenols across the board block that COMT enzyme I mentioned.
Really?
So they raise adrenaline. So part of the reason I got so good at what I do is because I have that double mutation. I'm so sensitive, you know, green tea extract, sends me off the deep end. Pretty much any polyphenol you can mention blocks that enzyme. So if I take any of those in a concentrated form, I am incredibly anxious, doomsday feeling. My life is over. I'm a fuck up. Can't sleep that night. Like, really fucks me up bad. And yes, they are in food sources like berries and stuff, but I haven't really noticed much from the natural amounts in food. It's more so when you concentrate it. And that's totally right. You know, we're making all these liposomal formulations, chemically modified curcumin for 20,000% increased absorption. And like, yes, you're going to get much better anti-inflammatory effects. Curcumin also raises adrenaline. So I took one of those modified forms of curcumin. I was similar to the polyphenols. Same thing. You're going to get the same. Let's say you get 50 times more anti-inflammation. You're going to get 50 times more of all the other effects. One of those effects being that it pulls minerals out of your body, pulls iron out of your body. I mentioned people losing hair. Women will be losing hair. Come to me. And they are extremely anemic, chugging iron supplements. And they're also taking this crazy mumbo jumbo double stacked curcumin product. And the holistic practitioner has no idea that that's why their iron won't go up. They're thinking it's gut biome, gut microbes, this or that or whatever, which can absolutely be true. But in reality, it's the curcumin there. So you remove that and their iron levels go up. And that just goes to show, how strong is that relative to other pharmaceuticals? You are chemically modifying it, and it is an amount that nature didn't intend. Now, that being said, people think, you know, taking supplements is not what nature intended. Well, then why did you get 5 mutations in how you produce serotonin? You're going to need some type of targeted support to feel okay. It's one thing to be healthy enough to pass your genes on. Like, cavemen had all these similar mutations. You know, that's where we got it from. And if I were a caveman, why would the COMT gene be beneficial if I'm always stressed all the time? Well, I'll be the anxious one looking around for the saber-toothed tiger while everyone else is relaxing. So I will pass those anxious genes on, that genes that may not have been favorable in certain conditions do get passed on. And like, I think even cavemen definitely got multiple sclerosis. Like, all these chronic diseases too, people act like just started now. Like, our ancient ancestors did get these things. You know, it's obviously, I think that with the toxic world, the things we eat, we're exposed to, and the stress, the rates are increasing. But it's not like these things never existed ever. Like, do I have proof to prove a caveman had multiple sclerosis? No. But just thinking intuitively about it, that some people, you've probably heard genetics load the gun and environment pulls the trigger. Sure. I like to say some people are born with their gun loaded with, you know, double dosed bullets and the trigger already 90% pulled. So one person could get multiple sclerosis living a far healthier lifestyle than someone else based on that perfect storm of certain genetic mutations.
Yeah. And I also think a lot of genetics is like certain predispositions. Like, I had a friend that we were talking about this weekend. He's type 1 diabetic, but he didn't get it till like midway through college. And it just, he was in a really stressed situation. He was in the army playing football, and all of a sudden his pancreas pretty much gave out, was in the hospital for a couple of days. And so it's like, if I had his genes, maybe I would have gotten it. Or if I was in the same situation, maybe I would develop MS. Like, kind of like the environment, you know, kind of what you just said or disagreed with a little bit, like the, maybe we have certain predispositions to certain genes that will influence what we end up contracting.
Absolutely. And the thing I like to point out too is people think of environment as a non-genetic factor, mm-hmm. but your genes dictate how sensitive you are to certain environmental factors. You can have mutations where you can't clear out specifically mercury or specifically lead. There are genes and proteins that do this. So of course, if you're never exposed to lead, no matter how bad your lead genes are, you won't get lead issues, you know? Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we're all exposed. We're all going to be exposed to toxins. You know, no one is completely clean anymore. So I know type 1 diabetes too is an autoimmune condition. That's why like vitamin D has been shown to help prevent with type 1 diabetes, because that helps a lot with autoimmunity and the immune system. So if someone has a whole bunch of mutations in the vitamin D pathway, vitamin D could possibly help with their type 1 diabetes. Now, is any one pathway usually the cure? No, it's always multifactorial for everything. And that's why I don't really like how the current medical system, they give you a drug to just bombard with so strongly one mechanism in your cells, bombard it. Mm-hmm. You can't focus, take Adderall and jack the living shit out of your dopamine and adrenaline. Do they even have dopamine mutations? If they do, you could take something like, I don't know, L-tyrosine or phenylalanine or something to moderately raise dopamine much more naturally. And then I bet high histamine in the brain is making them all brain foggy, so they can't focus as well. So you could stimulate multiple, I think naturally stimulating multiple pathways that are genetically need support more minorly gives a better overall feeling and results than just bombarding one mechanism. Because yes, that's why the SSRIs don't work so well for a lot of people, just a lot of numbing effects. Because just because you're depressed doesn't mean your serotonin's low. There was a paper that came out, people were saying how, oh yeah, serotonin is not a factor in it. That paper was so misconstrued. I think serotonin is absolutely a role for a lot of people with depression, but certainly not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Was this the paper about I forget what it was called, but it was the one that came out like a couple, I think 6 months ago. It was about the SSRIs being kind of like a failure. And whatever effect the SSRIs were having, it wasn't from serotonin. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was that one. Yeah. They looked at like, I think one or two genetic mutations and did association studies. And also they were also checking, they were comparing people that never took SSRIs to people that took SSRIs their whole life. And how are you going to compare that if they took a drug their entire life? That's a huge confounding variable. Mm-hmm. And they only checked one genetic mutation and compared it to all of that. I think they checked the serotonin reuptake transporter. You could have mutations in how you synthesize serotonin. And I mentioned how you reuptake it, also how you break it down. You can have individual mutations in each individual serotonin receptor. So I work with people, their serotonin levels genetically look pretty much fine, but they have mutations in a specific serotonin receptor. And we give them some targeted treatment like CBD, CBDA, lavender. They all activate the serotonin 1A receptor, which is pretty frequently mutated. And giving them an SSRI will stimulate it'll help stimulate that receptor, but then you'll be overstimulating the regular receptors that don't need that extra attention, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about how, let's say someone has that gene for the serotonin 1A receptor, I think you said, how do you know that they have low serotonin from that? And how do you know that they're not compensating by producing a ton of that receptor, or that could go with any protein like the CMT as well?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I always go by symptoms first and foremost. So going off of that and looking at a few of the studies that show that it can have depression comorbid with anxiety. So if they're dealing with that, and there are tests you can do, neurotransmitter tests, but they're very, very expensive. So it's one of those things. It's always a highly, highly, highly educated guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Unless sometimes I'm looking at the blood work, but blood work, again, you don't just test for serotonin with that because it's not in the blood. It's in the cerebral spinal fluid. And you said that there's some compensation mechanism. That's a really, really good point. Cells are really, really smart. And that's why if you give someone an SSRI, they'll have withdrawals. And I think something, one thing that people don't recognize is I'm very sensitive and in tune with my body. So any supplement or product I take for a while, if I just stop it, I notice some sort of withdrawal. Now, it's not, you know, if I stop taking my multivitamin and my Shilajit that I've been taking every day, and if I stop taking that for a day or two, like I will be a little less, like, am I going to be beside myself, depressed, anxious, can't get shit done? No, because it's not a pharmaceutical. Mm-hmm. But anything that you're taking over time, you'll get used to. But at the end of the day, it's not that horrible for a withdrawal. But just so you get what I'm saying, there's always a compensatory effect with pretty much everything people take. But it's all about strategically picking. Like, if I know it's a day that I woke up later, slept in, and don't have much going on, like, I won't really have much caffeine at all, if any, just because I don't need it that day. So if someone has that receptor that's mutated, not work as well, that's just one of seven main receptors. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the body would start pumping out more serotonin to do that. But if they did, then they probably wouldn't be having as many of those issues. That makes sense. So I always try to lead by the genes, at least 90% of the time, like multiple genes pointing to this supplement makes sense for you. At least 9 out of 10 times it ends up working, but sometimes, you know, it doesn't agree with them. And as much as we know about genetics, there's a shit ton more we don't know. So just because based on the current data we have, it's suggesting this, maybe 5 years from now, we'll learn about mutations that reveal, okay, it was good for these 5 mutations, but there's 5 other mutations it's not so good for, if that makes sense. So it's all about doing the best that you can with the given information that there is. Mm-hmm. That's why I like using self-decode, using artificial intelligence to really take a whole bunch of data and not just look at one gene. Like for their low mood scores, they'll take hundreds of thousands of genes into account with the AI to give you an overall risk score to try and remove. That's going to be the future for sure, not just one gene. However, let's just say someone has high stress score, high risk for stress. You do need to know some of what those specific mutations are so you know what mechanism you need to supplement. People think of it as, I'm anxious, give me a supplement or drug. There's not one anxiety pathway. There's so many different calming pathways that can individually be mutated. So yeah, does Xanax work for everybody to calm them down? Sure. But if you don't have that many GABA mutations, it could be a severe magnesium deficiency due to mutations in the magnesium transporter. It could be mutations in the endocannabinoid system. So high-dose CBD could be exactly what you need. So again, infinite flavors of any disease or ailment, and trying to find not what supplement addresses the symptom, what mechanism addresses the disrupted mechanism in the cell.
Yeah, that's interesting. Going off of that, so let's say like you have a gene mutation in the transporter where it's like you have faulty transporters. Do you typically, and I don't know if you can do this, but like, do you typically go the route of like, all right, let's increase the, let's say magnesium for how much, so there's more to be transported? Or could you go about maybe dietarily trying to increase the transporter and maybe hitting a supplement that does that? Is that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Yeah. So it's the thing with epigenetics is that's what you inferred. Like, what supplement could I take to raise the magnesium transporter? The thing with epigenetics is there's no specificity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't, like, it's, I feel like it's more so like either good epigenetic expression or bad, if that makes sense. Like, there's not really precise, okay, I want to increase my magnesium transporter, but not affect my adrenaline transporter. You know, like we don't really know that much how to do that. But for absorption mutations, just giving your body more of that, so there's higher probability of it working. But then also, of course, limiting gut inflammation, gut infections, those can further impact overall nutrient absorption. That's why gut health is so important. But even in good gut health, and one gene can be mutated tens of thousands of areas on it. Now, we don't know what pretty much nearly all of them do, if that makes sense. We only have, relative to what's out there, the information we have, self-decode has information for the magnesium transporter, 20 to 30,000 mutations there. We have the ID, we have the letters A, T, C, or G, but there's no, we have, not every mutation actually does something. It doesn't change that film reel. It doesn't always change what protein. It could change the protein, the amino acid, but if it's not on a critical area of the protein, it may not affect the protein function. So I've had some people that do self-decode. They're like, oh my God, I have so many mutations in this. And I'm like, well, you have no idea what those actually mean. And honestly, I don't know either. If there's some study to go off of, like, example I like to give, this mutation that breaks down GABA. Now, this study didn't show if you have this mutation, you have higher or lower GABA. What they showed was people with this mutation respond better to, I think it was benzodiazepines. So I interpret that, and they're also more prone to anxiety. So you kind of read between the lines here. What causes higher anxiety? Lower GABA. So if you have lower GABA, that means you're going to notice much better improvements because you're further from your normal, you're in a deeper deficit, if that makes sense. You kind of following me here? Mm-hmm, yeah. So then if you take a Xanax or a benzodiazepine, you're going to have a lot more room to improve upon because you have a lot bigger of a ditch, I guess, for your GABA. So it's one of those things that I don't always need to have that exact study showing it raises this thing. You can look at these different clues and assemble many different converging points of evidence. Let's just say they prove A causes B and then they prove B causes C. I can infer that A causes C. But then some people in the evidence-based community, they use it so rigidly. No, you need the humanized, randomized control trials showing that A causes C. And it's like, read between the lines here. And you also got to remember, I'm interested in true optimization, being the best you can be every minute. And the studies that people do, the level of sensitivity for a lot of these tests isn't that good. If you're asking people how they feel on something, 100 people, you know, how good are people at self-reporting, if that makes sense? You know, okay. So it's the minor difference. If I have like a headache and I feel off for 3 hours, I want to get rid of that throughout my day. So if you were to do a biochemical analysis, it may not show much difference on the blood work, but I still feel that. What people feel not feeling good, I think, is often below the level of detection for a lot of these clinical trials, clinical studies. People saying, oh, gluten doesn't lead to all these diseases or whatever. Well, gluten itself doesn't, but on top of all these other things, it may.
And people everyone in the boat, but like the evidence-based community, they kind of deny anecdote a lot of times. And anecdote is evidence. Like that is yes. True. It's just obviously yeah. It's not in a systematic review or that stuff, but it doesn't mean it's not true.
Well, not true or not valid, especially when a lot of what I do is not directly backed by clinical data. I'm way ahead of where the science is at. Mm-hmm. So anecdotes matter, especially when you're way ahead of the science and that's all you have to go off of. And that's why I'm always taking on clients, because I need to get more information about what's working. But I've seen probably 130 or so clients since I started doing this officially. And the patterns are really presenting themselves. Like I work with some people with Alzheimer's on the autism spectrum and trying some things, supporting methylation in certain ways that I wouldn't really try with a normal person. Try with the first client, ended up working pretty good. Second one worked pretty good. Third one. So you start to build this pattern like, oh, that actually makes sense. I don't have a rule book. I don't have a textbook. There's no rubric or anything for me to really go off of. It's all just reading the studies and thinking critically and trying to draw these conclusions, make these links for this paper from 1997 suggesting this herb or whatever. Oh, this may work for this specific type of mutation. Let's try it. We're talking all natural over-the-counter supplements. It's not, what's the worst case scenario? You try it. It either does nothing. You feel nothing. Or maybe a little anxious for a day. You don't sleep for a night, little nausea. And then we know it doesn't work for you. And then what? You wasted $30, which in the grand scheme, people are used to paying tens of thousands for functional labs to really go nowhere with it. So that's why I really love being all over the counter. All I'm doing is pointing people in the right direction. And the risk is virtually non-existent. You're not going to get people hooked on these things.
Mm-hmm. Have you read William J. Walsh's work at all?
No.
You should check that out for sure. He wrote a book called the Nutrient Power. And basically he's doing exactly what you're doing. He is I don't think he's a psychiatrist, but he worked in psychology and he treated basically, I think like 30,000 patients over his lifetime. He's still alive. And he basically classified all these disorders from depression, anxiety, all this stuff into certain boxes, which he tested. I believe he tested their nutrients And he would find that they were under-methylated, over-methylated. They had toxicity in certain metals, and then he used the nutrients to treat them. So it's basically what you're doing, but then you could probably back end that with some genetic testing, compare that with the HDMA, or do the other way around. And
yeah,
probably.
Yeah. Interesting. That sounds really cool. I'll definitely check that out. And I love that you mentioned the over-methylation, because MTHFR, everyone talks about it, take the methyl B vitamin, and people with that slow COMT that I mentioned I have, mm-hmm. super, I see a lot of people come to me. I have MTHFR, I was put on methyl B vitamins, and they're so stressed because people that break down adrenaline slow will get very anxious on methyl B vitamins, even a low, low dose of it. People would be on methyl vitamins for too long. Just because you have MTHFR does not mean your homocysteine is high. That does not mean necessarily you're under-methylating. There are other proteins. You can have MTHFR working poorly, so your homocysteine should be higher. Then you can have another three mutations that make you break down homocysteine through a different pathway quicker than normal. So it will cancel out. And I've seen people overdoing the methylation support for way too long without testing. And those symptoms are just as bad as under-methylating.
Interesting. So do you see any downsides to the non-methylated B12? And I know you don't like folic acid, but so we'll stick to B12, I guess.
Yeah. So you're probably referring to the cyano one. I honestly don't really recommend that to anyone anymore. I mean, can people get an effect? Yes. But I personally take adenosyl and hydroxyl B12. Those are both methyl-free versions, but they're ready to be used by your cells. So like the adenosyl is used directly by your mitochondria to make ATP. So it helps a lot with energy. Now, good example here too is how much we don't know. The enzyme that converts methyl B12 into hydroxyl, no, into adenosyl B12. Mm-hmm. We know what that enzyme is. I have all this data on what my mutations are, but we have no idea what anything does about it. So it's one of those things like, oh, I wish I could tell people they can't make adenosyl B12 as much. You get what I'm saying? So that's why I pretty much put people on methyl B12, hydroxyl B12, adenosyl B12, and a combination of those. And they're a bit more expensive relative to the B12, but I mean, I think it more than pays for itself with how you're feeling, because there's a lot of other mutations that can impair that beyond just MTHFR, as I mentioned. Sure, you make the methyl B12, you have no MTHFR, but if you can't make adenosyl B12 as well, you're not going to be making as much ATP in your mitochondria. And people talk about mitochondrial dysfunction, but people don't talk about that mechanism there, which I think is hugely, hugely important. But again, there's no information about what those mutations do. So right now I just have hypotheses. You know, if I give someone adenosyl and their life literally changes right away, maybe that could be due to that mutation, but I have no way of actually knowing.
Yeah. When do you recommend taking like a B12 adenosyl versus just being like, hey, like you should try eating more meat, more eggs, things like that?
Yeah. So I think that a lot of people I work with are doing mostly pretty much all the right things. And I think it's not working because they have these genetic mutations. I'm trying to think of an example of there are certain mutations that are present. We have statistical data in like 20% of the population, yet 3/4 of my clients have it. Why is that? I think that's because I'm artificially selecting for people with worse genes. Because if you're seeking someone out like me, I am not the first stop people go to. You know, usually it's a long list and people are like, I've tried everything except the genes. So if you tried everything and nothing worked except the genes, I think it makes sense that it skews statistically towards you have a lot of these gene mutations. Like the people that have these quadruple MTHFR mutations with all these other methylation mutations, they're the ones that show up with chronic mold, chronic Lyme, chronic EBV, chronic gut infections, similar with all these vitamin D mutations. And it's like, obviously it's the environment. You need to be hit with a mold spore, but no matter what, we're going to come in contact with a mold spore again. So yes, I think people act like it's 90, 100% environment, very minimal genes. I think it's at least 50%, 51% genetics making you more sensitive to these environmental things. Why do some people in a family living in the same house get super bad mold issues and others don't? It's the same environment. So obviously the environmental load is definitely important, but I would say on the record, 51% genetic. I don't know if it's, you know, 51 or 70 or whatever, but I do think that the people that get the most sick from these environmental things, I think it's mostly due to the genes versus the exposure. But again, you always need the exposure in the first place.
That's true. So how do you view, so like 98%, I believe, is of our DNA is non-coding, which means it's kind of just sits there more or less. And it has to do largely with gene expression, I believe. How do you like explain and how do you view that in your work?
Yeah. So currently I'm not looking at non-coding DNA. That's so self-decode doesn't look at non-coding DNA. Really? That would be something called more so whole exome sequencing, where they sequence every single letter you know. I know Nebula Genomics is a company that does that. That's definitely going to be the end game, but I think it's like $1,000, $2,000 just to get sequenced. So when I was figuring out how to structure my practice, I decided to do self-decode, which is more probe-based. They sequence certain areas like 23andMe, Ancestry DNA, but self-decode uses the AI to impute a lot more data. So you could take a 23andMe data file. I think it's, I want to say it's like 47,000 genes, something like that. And you get from that same data, you get 100 million mutation information from self-decode. And that's due to the AI, but you're still not getting every single letter, the entire thing of the non-coding regions. So that would be something more like the whole exome sequencing. Not a doubt in my mind, whether it's 3, 5, 10 years from now, like that's what I'll be using just to be able to literally see everything. But I wanted this to be accessible to people. And, you know, the DNA test kit itself is like $100. So that's a lot more accessible for people. But they do use the whole exome sequencing a lot in more clinical stuff, like in conventional medicine. That's what they use for sequencing tumor cells and stuff, because you can have mutations in the non-coding areas that, as you mentioned, will affect how much of that receptor do you express on the cell. So you can have a receptor that works better or worse. You can also have mutations in how many of the receptors are there. So it's kind of like if you have a receptor that's not as well functioning, but you express it a lot more, you maybe almost be able to break even, if that makes sense. Yeah, if you have more of them that don't work as well versus less of them that work better. But, you know, this is how my mind thinks. It's so detail focused, like very nitty gritty, molecular, mechanistic. But it sucks because science doesn't come, you know, the technology to do all that, you know, there's no grand interest in that versus all the other stuff they're researching to make other drugs and stuff, you know. But like the inquisitive mind, you have inquisitive mind too, I could tell, you know, just by the questions you're asking, like that's what makes it so cool, you know, molecularly like that.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think it's great that you think that way. It's awesome to just put, when you put the pieces together, it makes it all worth it every once in a while. You're like the light bulb moments.
Exactly.
So there are, every time your cells replicate, there are certain mutations. Most of them are SNPs, right? Like single nucleotide polymorphisms. The other stuff don't really happen that much, only because they usually get deleted, right? Like the cell will go through apoptosis. Okay. Because that's like cancer, partially at least.
Well, to be clear, so the SNPs get fixed as well. So that would kind of be like, so if a SNP doesn't get fixed, that's what can lead to cancer as well. Okay. So once you're already born, but during, you can have rearrangements of DNA. I believe, I could be wrong with this. I think it's at this, when it's the egg or sperm, or maybe when they first meet, it could shuffle around a bit. But once the cells, well, then there's the whole topic of transposons, which are basically areas of your genome that can hop and skip around, like, throughout your life as well. They're basically like viral-like components that they think we got from viruses. That is next to me during my PhD did a transposon work, and like they were doing it with ALS, how the hopping and skipping throughout your life, you hop in the wrong place, a segment of DNA can lead to something like ALS. So that's a whole other world. I'm already complicated enough as is, you know, but like a lot of these diseases, and that's a whole other root cause for certain diseases, are these transposable elements that literally jump one DNA here to another area. And imagine taking a whole segment of DNA, not one letter, and you could duplicate it into another area of your DNA or just copy paste, cut paste. Huge headache. Let's steer out of that one, because I'm not too familiar with those. That's a whole other field.
Sounds good. But so like theoretically, like, these SNPs, the single letter mutations, they do accumulate over time, right? In our non-sexual genes, like they, you over as you age, you would your genes would probably defer a little bit from like your head to your toe slightly, right? Or am I wrong on that?
Yeah, no, not really. So once that does occur, once you start having a couple of SNPs getting their way through, like cancer starts by, that's called a de novo mutation. De novo meaning it happened, de novo, like I think that's Latin for like new, like it happens like right then and there. It's when those de novo mutations, whether it's one letter or a segment, once that cell doesn't get killed or like forced to like go under programmed cell death, it's a little bit wonky, a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginnings of what's called genomic instability, unstable genetics. So that mutation increases the odds of getting another mutation. So over time, you get more and more and more of them. But the genome throughout all of your healthy cells, non-cancerous cells, will all be identical. Now, obviously, the gene expression, like we mentioned before, what genes are expressed, that's what makes the cells so different in size, function, nutrient requirements, and things. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. So, yeah, perfectly. So I wanted to ask about this. You have stem cells, and I wanted to hear your opinion on this. So like stem cells, what I've been told, at least in one perspective, is that stem cells are kind of like a naked cell. So if we imagine methylation is like, I kind of like imagine like pinpoints being put on it so that it changes certain expression. And stem cells are basically an unmethylated cell that haven't been given any directions, right? Like it's kind of like you have the same baby and it could go a million different ways depending on what school you put it in or whatever. Do you agree with that, or where does that fall short?
Yeah, so definitely agree with what you said. I'm honestly not sure if I don't think the cells are just not methylated at all. Okay. So I'm not sure if it'd be like a clean slate. There's no methylation, but what you said being like, you know, a primitive form that can go any direction based on what schooling you put in, what cell environment, what cellular signaling cues. So what influences the stem cell? It's ingredients and molecules released from other cells, whether they're nearby, far away. So that's what influences. That's a good way you put it with the schooling of the cell. What cellular inputs there are. Like in your brain, they release cues to get the stem cells to migrate to certain areas to help form your spinal cord, to help form your mouth, to form your asshole, you know, to get like directionality of all of that. Yeah, so I'm not sure about the methylation. It's definitely, clearly it's a very, very unique, different methylation status. But I could be wrong, but I don't think it would just be no methylation has happened yet. Because you think about it, a stem cell just sitting there, even if it wants to move, that's a change in epigenetics. Because if it wants to move, you have to synthesize new proteins in the cytoskeleton to attach to the collagen to pull itself along. That only happens by making new proteins, which is due to the changes in epigenetics. So epigenetics just aren't a monthly, yearly, decade-wide thing slowly as you age. They're changing every picosecond, millisecond, whatever, you know, the most tiniest scale of time you could think of, because you look at a cell under a microscope and you have like these membrane blebs and you could like see stuff moving around, and like those are all moving around by changes in epigenetics, by changing the cell behavior. So in order for a cell to do anything different than it's currently doing, it's going to have to change the epigenetics.
And I think you said this before, but so that's where you think a lot of the differences between like your brain and your foot lie, like because you have the same gene, but just how the methylation is, that how it's expressed, that's changing.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And then you have like the brain, which is in the spinal cord, central nervous system, which is separate from the blood. So you're going to have different nutrients floating around there. So, you know, you could be further like your skin cell, your liver cell, and your intestinal cell, or, you know, your kidney cell, like they're kind of all exposed to similar-ish fuel and nutrients, but like your central nervous system cells, completely different, you know, cocktail of things. It's literally not blood. It's a different fluid entirely. So that can kind of further that's why there's that blood-brain barrier. And that's why people get so fucked up when that blood-brain barrier gets disturbed, because you're letting a bunch of stuff in there that should not be in there. And what'll that'll do? That'll give all these brain cells other cellular inputs and change their epigenetics, usually towards a more inflamed state.
Interesting. Yeah, that is crazy. So I wanted to dive a little bit more into like how your genes influence your metabolism and like your digestion and nutrient absorption. So like where do you start with that?
So there's mutations in how, I mean, so first when you're eating the food, how well are you digesting it? And there are certain pathways, and you can go very indirect, I'll say, with this, like proper B12, proper zinc, a lot of other micronutrients are required to synthesize and create hydrochloric acid in your gut. So it's like, you could make the argument that the B12 mutations affect digestion, you know, and that's kind of how I view this. It's not always, I look at like, think of the ripple effect. Like, what is everything that's needed to get this started? And whether it's zinc, you know, magnesium or B12 or all these different things can have different absorption rates. But I think you meant regarding like how you can absorb, how you can utilize nutrients differently. Correct.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So there can be a lot of different mutations in how you, there's so many chemical modifications that occur for any macronutrient. Like I know one of the ones I like to mention is with linoleic acid. So it's omega-6 fatty acid. It is pro-inflammatory, but it's used to make something called arachidonic acid, which is used to make endocannabinoids in our bodies. So excessive omega-6 is bad. You know, I'm not saying go drink vegetable oil, you know, but people that I work with, they get so caught up by listening to someone like a carnivore MD, like you can't have any omega-6 at all. You know, like he's saying you want to have a good ratio, and that ratio is going downhill. I do agree with that. But that's an omega-6 fatty acid, and that gets converted into something called gamma linoleic acid, GLA. That's anti-inflammatory. That is one of the number one supplements. And when I see people come to me with joint pain, they very frequently have a mutation in how the enzyme that converts linoleic acid into gamma linoleic acid. So they eat this omega-6 fatty acid and they're not able to make the anti-inflammatory version. Mm-hmm. And that's been directly linked to gut, skin, joint inflammation. And you look at studies, GLA supplementation helps with that because it's anti-inflammatory. But if you have a harder time making that, that can lead to, like, for people with joint pain, borage seed oil or black seed oil are two of my favorites because they're very, very rich in GLA. Now, even if you don't have that, if someone comes to me with severe joint pain, based on the data I have, they don't have that mutation, I still may recommend GLA. You know what I mean? It's not like it won't work for you if you don't have that exact mutation. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But does that kind of answer your question? Or were you asking more about like how you use it for like fat loss or?
Oh, no, you were spot on. I think I saw you talk about this a little bit. Like, do you think you'll find the perfect diet? So I'm from the Ray Peace sphere. So we have kind of like, I think we have a similar view and perspective that we're trying to figure out how to get a cell to a high functioning state, a high energy state. Yeah. And yeah, you come out from like a slightly different perspective. Like you come out maybe like the back end versus we're like, put this stuff in to get into it. Which I think can be very complimentary. Do you think we'll find like a perfect diet through genetics for you?
For each individual, yes. But for every person across the board, absolutely not. I mean, just think about if you're, you know, Northern European versus in the tropics, we evolved over these millennia to do better with people. Northern Europeans usually do better processing fatty animal meats versus, you know, not that they can't tolerate fruits, like, but versus vice versa, you know, these mutations that, when you look at it from an evolutionary, I was really interested in evolutionary biology when they did, you know, the phylogeny, like, you know, the sea sponge turns into the walrus, which turns, you know what I mean? Like all that stuff wasn't really interesting. But when you think about why do certain populations have these mutations, you know, I think it's based on what the evolutionary pressure was for that. I don't think there'll ever be one good diet for everybody because we're all so genetically diverse. And that's one of the things I really dislike about a lot of the stuff on social media. It's so absolutist and extremist. Like Carnivore MD, I mentioned, like, great message overall, limit seed oils, which I agree with. And then a lot of people in the evidence-based community say there's no trials showing that it directly causes something, but like they throw out any mechanistic data, any anecdotes. But it's one thing when a bullshit wellness person scaremongers with one mechanism. I will show you a massive amount of evidence indirectly supporting that to the point where it's like, I've connected so many dots here. I'm fairly confident in this. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But eat more organ meats. Great. Avoid plant nutrients, plant defense chemicals. Yes and no. Some people have mutations. If kidney stones run in your family, you most likely cannot process oxalates very well. So you should avoid kale and spinach. But if you can process them well, you don't have those mutations, your gut is in good health, because gut infections can also affect how you metabolize these things. So it's not just the genes. Mm-hmm. But well, the genes will also influence how easy you are to get infected, but kind of indirectly there. But plants also have so many beneficial nutrients that have been shown to promote favorable epigenetic expression, reduce aging, lower inflammation, promote health. So it's all about what's pros versus cons for you. If you're super sensitive to the negatives, the pros may not be worth it for you. And you know what? If you want to get the pros of that, maybe take a supplement with an isolated molecule from those plants. If you can't tolerate the other stuff in the plant, take a targeted supplement for that. But acting as if everyone should be avoiding these things is really ridiculous. And it drives me nuts, because I think Carnivore MD knows better. No, he is a doctor. He knows that. But I mean, how many followers does he have now? He built a whole machine based on all that. Liver King got busted, you know, for obvious fucking reasons. But it's just like...
No, I'm just joking.
Oh, you know. Oh, yeah. Everyone listening probably knows that one. Yeah, you got me on that one. But you need to eat what's right for you. And sometimes it may be hard to tell. The genetics can tell you. Like the oxalate report from Self Decode, I can't remember off the top of my head, it probably has at least a couple dozen, maybe a couple hundred individual mutations that they take all into account to give you that. And when I asked someone with that gene report, do kidney stones run in your family? I'd say probably 70% or so say yes. But just because they say no, kidney stones are late stage oxalate toxicity. Mm-hmm. There's so many, they form crystals. What happens before then? You're going to have chronic immune dysfunction. It's been shown that oxalates turn your immune cells towards a more pro-inflammatory state. So what's that going to manifest as? Well, inflammation manifests very differently for every different person. Some people it's joints, some people it's skin, some people it's gut, some people it's brain. So even if they say no, it doesn't mean that oxalates may not help them if they remove them. But I also try not to overload clients too much with... regarding the diet type stuff with the genes, I focus on what genes will cause more inflammation or lead to more brain fog or lead to leaky gut. I'm not entirely the data regarding what diet will help you lose the most weight. The data isn't as there is data for that. I personally haven't gotten I don't do full meal plans for my clients, at least not yet. It'll be more so, hey, you're sensitive to histamine. Read some articles. BuzzFeed articles are fine. Top 10 high histamine foods. Read 4 of them. You'll probably see some themes. If you see some foods you eat a lot, try cutting back on them. That's kind of where I'm at with the diet side of things. I'm not a nutritionist, but you know, I know more than the regular person about nutrition, obviously, how it functions with the cells. I do want to try and offer more packaging where there's more support for stuff like that. But getting back to what you said, there'll never be one best diet for everybody unless we continue to interbreed over millennia and millennia, where we're all pretty much the exact same. It reminds me of, this is a stretch. Did you ever watch Fairly Odd Parents growing up?
Yeah.
Do you remember that one show where it's like the gray blobs?
Vaguely.
It's like gray blobs where they're all the exact same. Everyone's the exact same. Like in my mind.
Or something.
What?
They keep like multiplying or something.
I don't remember that part. I just remember them all being the exact same. And I'm imagining the only way we could have one perfect diet for everybody is if we interbred so much, there was no such thing as race anymore. We eradicated all the differences we have evolutionarily and just interbred. It'd probably take, I don't even know how many millions or hundreds of thousands of years, but like if we were all looked the exact same skin color, same, all that type of stuff, then maybe it would work. But in the near future, and by near, I mean next several hundred generations of people, there won't be one perfect diet.
You ever seen that Time magazine that they came out with? Like, we're all moving towards looking like it was like this light skin person.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
I mean, I do think that is occurring. And I think too that you're having demographics of people interbreed now that we're all globally connected that would never interbreed evolutionarily. You know, like if someone from, I don't know, China is mating with someone from South America, or Sweden with someone from Mexico, or whatever, all these different things. You can be introducing certain combinations of things that it may minimize risk for things, but I think it also can increase risk for things. Do I have specific examples off the top of my head, no, but just thinking intuitively with it, I do think that makes sense. Like I know that the, like the COMT mutation is more prevalent among Caucasians. I think MTHFR, I forgot what the MTHFR, but different mutations have different prevalence. Like certain mutations associated with gut inflammation are more prevalent in African-Americans, or it's African, sorry, African descent. And what do you know? The rates of colorectal cancer are very, very high for African people of African descent. So, yeah.
So I kind of want to play devil's advocate for a second, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned avoiding histamine for people that are very histamine intolerant. But what about like the, you know, the environmental aspect where it's like maybe we could eat more copper rich foods to increase our ability to detoxify histamine, or maybe just, and you mentioned this, like eating less gut irritating foods so your digestion improves, so you release less histamine in response to the digestive process and the LPS and all that stuff leaking through.
Yeah. So regarding the copper thing you said, that's good in practice. Mm-hmm. But what does copper also do? Copper also is used by the enzyme that converts dopamine into adrenaline. So I've had histamine issues. I tried a copper supplement and I was tweaking the fuck out all day because I'm going to be very, very sensitive to copper because I'm very sensitive to adrenaline. So you see that ripple effect I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do you mention initially with your question with the regarding the histamine? Was it asking about so like
avoiding histamine? So like histamine is largely released. I mean, it's released a lot of areas, but like in terms of things leaking through the gut lining and like the endotoxin, the serotonin that's released when food gets through your colon and the bacteria start turning over and you get an increased endotoxin load in response, which releases the histamine and the nitric oxide to like kind of, you know, detoxify that, kill it with its reactive oxygen species. So like my like question is like, maybe it's not, or my like playing devil's advocate is like, maybe it's not the histamine rich foods that are inherently the problem, which obviously they can be, but that sometimes you just need to avoid gut irritating foods or foods that you don't digest well to decrease your histamine response.
Well, I think they're virtually the same though. The foods you can't digest well are the foods high in histamine because histamine directly affects the digestive process.
Interesting.
Like, so like high gut histamine is linked to reduced secretion of hydrochloric acid in the gut. So, and then you also have, like you mentioned, like bad gut bacteria, or even some good bacteria, like some probiotics. I work with clients that are histamine intolerant and the probiotics they're taking either contain histamine or produce histamine. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean they're necessarily bad bacteria. There are bad pathogenic gut bacteria that make histamine as well, but there's also some good ones with health benefits that, for someone like me, histamine intolerant doesn't work very well. Like all the fermented beverages, kombucha, apple cider vinegar, like kimchi, extremely high in histamine. So again, the pro versus con thing I was mentioning, I instantly feel the brain fog, kind of lose my appetite, just don't feel like myself if I have any of that, because they are very, very high in histamine by default due to that fermentation process. But does that kind of answer your question there, that like the histamine foods, high histamine foods in your gut, you can have gut bacteria producing high histamine. Then you also have foods you're allergic to, which are different. You can be allergic to a food that's not high in histamine, but it makes your own mast cells release histamine. Mm-hmm. So the first two I mentioned, your body didn't make that histamine, but you still absorb that histamine and it adds to the overall histamine load throughout your body. Now, going back to what I mentioned before, we don't know why, same with inflammation. We don't know, it's histamine is a form of inflammation. We don't know why some people, their histamine causes their ADHD or versus hives versus psoriasis versus, you know, joint pain. We don't know why, it's called organotropism. We don't know why certain organ types are affected for certain people versus others. My brother and I have very similar genetics for histamine breakdown. Mine is predominantly pretty much all brain type stuff. He has some more skin type issues, but we're very genetically similar. So we don't know exactly why to that degree. We'd love to know. But does that kind of answer what you were saying with the devil's advocate?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any speculation as to what could be the root cause of some of the organotropism?
If I had to do a really far reach off the top of my head right now, a paper I read during my PhD was showing that the expression of certain proteins on, I think the expression of certain proteins on immune cells, it'd probably be the mast cells, that makes the most sense, can traffic them to certain types of organs. So there was a study that did, I think it was breast cancer cells. So cells release these things called extracellular vesicles. They're called exosomes, we'll just call it that. And they're like little messengers that cells can send across your body. That's how they communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. Your blood, your urine contains so much exosomes. That's what ultimately transmits messages across all of your cells. That's what I actually studied for my PhD. It was exosomes with breast cancer. They've done studies that giving exosomes, purified exosomes. So it's like millions of times smaller than a cell. There's no nucleus. It's literally just little, think of like little pieces of mail. They can have proteins. They can have receptors on them. Taking exosomes from the blood of depressed mice and giving just the exosomes to depressed, non-depressed mice will make them depressed. And vice versa. And the paper I read was showing that certain types of proteins called integrins on the surface of these things, it let cancer cells decide where they metastasize to, whether it was the brain, the bone, the lungs. So that's the first paper I read about organotropism. So if I had to do a really far-reaching thing right now, mm-hmm. I would think that a similar thing, certain proteins being expressed on the mast cells make them go to certain organs more preferentially. Now, is that due to a genetic mutation in the integrins? Maybe not. I think it's more so the type of integrins. That may be more to epigenetics. Mm. You know, what is doing that? Or it could be a mutation as well. But that's definitely a far-reaching thing there. But like, again, that's an example, though, of how my brain works. Like that literally just reached into my brain. This was, you know, not pre-rehearsed at all and just had that. You know, it makes sense intuitively. Like now, imagine if I had did some research and I had 10 other papers pointing towards something similar like that. That's how I develop these types of ideas. Or I'll run into something where, okay, two clues saying yes, and then, oh, nope, read a paper, dead in the water. You know, it just doesn't make sense, you know, because you can have clues can point towards something. That's why you need a lot of clues to point there. Because you can find two or three studies to back up anything you want.
Yeah.
But once you have 10 to 20 different mechanisms pointing towards something, and you're not really finding anything that's saying no to that, that's when I get these more educated guesses on how, on just science overall.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the sad things about, I'm crapping on the evidence-based community right now a little bit, but like the like, it's like that was great. I was speculative. You could be dead on and you could be dead wrong, but like no one like just admits like this is speculative. Like
I totally really agree, man. Wrong. Don't be afraid. I think it's so fucking sad. Like all that these people do, you just read papers and just take the result and that's it. There's no critical thinking about that. And a lot of these nutritional studies too, or like I said, the inflammatory studies, the people that say, you know, you can have gluten, that's fine. This and that. You got to be way more nuanced than that. There's a reason why people aren't feeling good. And a lot of these people too, these nutritional PhDs or some of these MDs, debunkers and stuff, they're concerned with keeping people alive or helping Aunt Sally go from being morbidly obese to just kind of overweight. You know what I mean? Like it's a very different goal than what my goal is. And it's really to optimize things. What is the best? Just because they act like the scale of issues is either it's fine for you, totally okay, or it gives you cancer, or it gives you heart disease, or it gives you this. It's like there's this huge, huge gray area there that they just completely miss. It's either or. There's no spectrum. Everything is on a spectrum. All these different flavors of things. And guess what? That makes it infinitely more complex. It makes it infinitely more difficult to understand. And people don't want to sit there and read and decipher all that. And that's fine. I'll do it for you. You know what I mean? I love this shit. You know, I love just thinking, if I were a cell, what would make me act like this or that? How can I sway the behavior of that cell? And yeah, it's way more fun to speculate, you know? And I must say that all these speculations that I've had as I'm working with these clients, like I'm almost saying, I don't want to come off cocky here. Like I'm almost waiting to be like, wrong, if that makes sense, because thus far the track record of these hypotheses I have is, I don't have an exact, you know, statistical percentage, but it's very high win rate. Yeah, I probably should start that. You know what I mean? Like I really like, it's a very high win rate, I guess, because when you have, like I said, when there's 15, 20 pieces of like, you ever see that meme? I think it's the guy from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where it's like all the dots, like a conspiracy theory shit, where it's like all ruffled hair with the board and stuff, whiteboard, like I would do whiteboard sessions and it would literally be like that, like mad fucking scientist shit. Like my hair's all over the place and I'm just like in it, zoned in, drawing these conclusions like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I really don't think, find someone that would have had an answer that you just said about why certain organs are affected like that with those ideas that I just had. Like, it's just not, you're not going to find someone like that because it's a different way of thinking, but it's that type of thinking that like, different type of thinking, like someone like Elon Musk. Like, I'm not saying I'm an Elon Musk. I'm not that cocky. You know what I mean? But like, still that type of outside of the box thinking, people saying, no, stick to this way, follow the data like this. It's way more nuanced than that. Follow and that's the where the innovation lies. And that's where you're going to get these huge changes. And my holistic genetic health optimization, it started with anxiety, depression, joint pain. But like I said, I'm starting to see people with Alzheimer's or ALS or autism, and they are getting improvements. I'm not going on the record right now saying I could reverse these diseases with natural supplements, not yet at least, but people are getting noticeable improvements. Now, to be fair, they're more moderate, minor cases, early cases of these. You know, I haven't really worked with people that are very severe cases, but imagine sharing my knowledge with actual experts in autism or actual experts in these things and putting, meshing these minds together and collaborating. That's where we're really going to dive into the medical sphere. But at the same point, do they really want that to happen? If I can make people need, even if I could cut, make people need, I don't know, half as much medication as they need, even if I don't get rid of all of it, they're not going to want that. That's not monetizable. And I hate, and then people in that evidence-based community too, they're like, oh, if they're trying to fear-monger you by saying they, it's like, that is true. There's so much malpractice in big pharma. Like, it's rigorously documented, like lying about how certain things work to doctors, people putting people on certain medications that they shouldn't have been on. There were no changes in trials, yet they're still pushing it. And I think it's a healthy mix of both. I think some stuff I see can be a little overblown at times, but the whole system is preyed on us being sick and weak. And it's like, imagine too, like I feel like supplement companies should write what type of people this supplement wouldn't be good for. Like I said, a lot of people mess themselves up with supplements, but realistically, if you were that company, why the fuck would you ever do that? It would just hurt your sales.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's not a knock to the supplement, you know, but it's, I don't know. It's very weird when it's a financial goal. At the end of the day, no matter how righteous your business is, your prime, one of your primary goals is still to make money. At the end of the day, like, that's just the whole point of it. And that's, you know, life isn't just a charitable thing that you just like work, bleed through your eyes and do everything for free. You know, it's just not how it works. You know, it's always a bit of both.
Yeah. I think that's one of the interesting things I feel, because I work for Umzu, we're a supplement company, and Christopher Walker. And one thing I fear a little bit about, it's like big supplement becoming a thing where it's just like, it's now everyone's blaming like supplement companies saying they're all scandalous. And I'm like, you gotta, you know, I think supplement companies really gotta, and certain ones are already great, but have to really make sure they're on top of their game and just say that like, they're not trying to scam you. Cause people are eventually going to flip it to like being the other side of things, in my opinion.
Like, yeah, like some of the stuff I see, and it's like, people ask me, why don't I start a supplement company? The problem is, knowing what I know, I would need infinite SKUs of everything for each different, you know, each different subset of people. And it's some of the stuff I see that's advertised, it's like ridiculous, the pricing for stuff. I look at it, I'm like, this is just straight up garbage. Mm-hmm. Or like, it's just, yeah, yeah. And it's, educating people about supplements makes the most sense to me. And I would just feel very weird. I don't like giving general supplement recommendations. You know, there are certain things I recommend to all my clients starting out, but most of them are on a case-by-case basis because I know they can harm somebody. Just so I want to optimize their health completely, I do not want to cause any harm at the same time. I want to help. I do not want to harm.
100%. Yeah, that's what I like to say about a lot of our supplements, because they're, a lot of them are, some we have individual like magnesium, but a lot of our supplements are like general formulations, which like for testosterone, let's say. And we think for the most people, this will probably be the best bang for your buck, but it's obviously not going to work for everyone. That's just the reality of the situation.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. 100%.
And that's what, back to that, like the evidence-based thing. I think one of the issues is that, like, I feel like everyone's just like starting to blame like, oh, it's highly processed foods. And I'm just like, well, what is so like, what makes it like, processing food isn't inherently bad. It's like, what is so bad about these processed foods? And they won't go into that answer. It's just like a vague cop-out answer, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. So I just wanted to maybe have a, I just wanted to have a couple more genetics questions and then maybe some other stuff. So you mentioned, have you ever heard of the Warburg effect, like metabolic respiratory defect?
Yeah.
So do you think in the terms of cancer that my view of it, it lays largely, at least at this point, that, you know, the metabolism, the cell, the mitochondria are going haywire and it starts generating a ton of reactive oxygen species, which then damages the DNA. Do you think there's the other side of that too, where it's like your DNA is damaged just through wonky replication and stuff, and that is also can be contributing backwards to the Warburg effect that caused the mitochondria to be messed up?
Yeah, like someone I mentioned, the infinite flavors of any disease, that includes cancer for sure. Now, yeah, I definitely think it could go both ways with that. And I think that too, like people saying like sugar feeds cancer, it's like, yes, that can be true. Like that's one of the things too. Like I'm a cancer biologist by training, but I don't, like I've had some people reach out to work with me that, you know, have cancer currently undergoing chemo, asking for diet advice. I'm like, honestly, like, you know, that's one thing where it's much, much trickier with that because keto, like for example, ketogenic diets have been shown to enhance the effect of chemotherapy. I think, I forgot what cancer type it was off the top of my head. It might've been prostate cancer. But if you look at the data for that, there's a wide spread of data points. Why does it work better for some, less for others? Due to the genetics of that cancer cell. And as I mentioned, well, tumor cells are known to have many different subpopulations of cells. That's why it's so hard to treat. Let's say you hit it with some radiation. You kill off, I don't know, let's just say there's 10 subpopulations, simplicity's sake. You kill off three of them. Well, guess what happened? Now you have those seven that are continuing to grow that are radiation resistant. Mm. So how do you organize that to knock out all of those different treatments? That's why everyone's heard how there's the golden cure pill for cancer locked away by big pharma. As a cancer biologist, I could tell you straight up not true. Even people with the same subtype of small cell lung cancer, each of their tumors can have completely different genetic subpopulations of cells that require different types of treatment. Now, these drugs, you make that work, it just so happens to work for enough of those cells for enough of the people. But what they are hiding, I guess, and not educating about properly is proper nutrition, is how to live a proper life, is to stop bombarding us with stress from the media that's meant to just turn us into consumers and make us stressed out. So we go and buy that Starbucks donut or whatever it is. Like that's where the deception lies. I don't think we will ever have a magic bullet cure for cancer across the board, similar to the diet thing. Yeah. I think we're going to cure cancer, quote, cure it, early detection. So remember those exosomes I mentioned to you that cells release? Mm-hmm. Cancer cells also release them as well. That's literally what I studied, cancer cell exosomes. So cancer cells have different genes than regular cells, different mutations. That means their exosomes do as well. So part of what my lab studied, what is going to be the next forefront of medicine, it's called liquid biopsy. It'll be, I think in three, five, 8 years, we're going to have a urine or blood test. You go once a year. It's going to check for like 12 different cancer types. Because long before that pancreatic cancer is stage 4 and you have symptoms, they're releasing exosomes into the bloodstream, into the urine. So if you can figure out, and this is kind of what I studied, what's different about a breast cancer cell exosome than a healthy cell exosome? That's step one. Step two is, how do you get a technique that's sensitive enough to detect that? Because these exosomes, bro, they're like incredibly, you think a cell is small. They're like way smaller than a cell, way, 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 way smaller. So how do you get a technique that gets enough of that from the blood? Is there enough in the urine? So it's more so that technology is going to change the world. And that's what's going to be, it's not going to be, oh, we're going to cure your cancer with this magic bullet. It's going to be, oh, based on your urine test, you have early stage pancreatic cancer. We're going to open you up. We're going to find that little pocket, that tiny tumor. It could be the size of your pinky nail. It could be tiny before it gets big and spreads. They're going to go look. They're going to find it. They're going to cut it out. Then they're going to test you down the road for those exosomes again. They're going to have no exosomes because they got rid of all the tumor.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would be pretty crazy.
It's wild, right? Like yeah. That's going to be the future for sure. That's going to be how we really eliminate cancer, but it's also a disease related to aging. So no matter what, unless I don't even know, some technology I can't even fathom right now. Like, you know, once we start you take care of your body right now. You know, you're in your 20s, 30s. I think that 100 years old is an easy bet. Easy bet. I think 100 years old is going to be the new 70, 75 for sure. Now, I don't know exactly how long we'll live after that, but I definitely think you keep training, working out, moving your body, limiting inflammation, giving your cells the right nutrients they need to thrive now will undoubtedly affect the aging process in the future.
Yeah.
On top of all the technological advances.
Yeah. Either way, I still think we still have to die somehow. So like it'll be interesting how we eliminate cancer and all that stuff. But it's probably just going to change. The name's just going to change, you know, we're going to die somehow unless, you know,
yeah.
Elon Musk puts us into Twitter permanently.
Yeah.
Speaking of aging, what are your thoughts? Like, I know you said you were trying to look more into this. Like, if you had to speculate again, like, what do you think is really driving aging at a cellular or genetic level? Like, do you think it's a telomerase? Have you looked into the methylation theory of aging at all?
Yeah, no, so definitely methylation. And again, it's a bit of everything. I definitely think that the telomeres absolutely implicated in that. I don't remember what it was. There was a fairly recent study that was able to extend telomeres. It might have been a gene editing study. I don't remember off the top of my head. There's absolutely the methylation side of it. But think about this. Dysregulated methylation, what does that mean? That means you're going to be turning the wrong genes on and off. And that same methylation, MTHFR stuff I mentioned to you, that's literally the machinery. Mm-hmm. So if you're over-methylating, under-methylating, if you're not monitoring that, giving yourself the proper nutrients, it's only going to get worse as you age. And let's just say cancer, for example. Let's say you get a cancer diagnosis age 60. Cancer forms from when the first cell forms, it can take decades. It does take decades for it to grow. If it's on your skin, you see that easier. But you get a cancer diagnosis at age 60, that cancer started as early as maybe your early 30s, maybe even late 20s, for sure, definitely in your 40s, mid 40s. So when you thought you were in good health, you really weren't in good health. People take so much chronic fatigue, brain fog, just because they don't want to kill themselves or just because they're not having panic attacks, they think they're okay. And that's part of my message too, is what I do is not solely reversing or fixing a really bad health ailment. It's also people that think, sometimes they come to me hey, I'm a high functioning business guy. I want to see if I can function a little bit better. I feel pretty good all the time. They work with me and they're like, wow, this is a big step up. And the reason why is because your cells have what they need. And if they have what they need now, the reason why you feel subpar, even if you don't feel like shit, I think most people, the vast majority of people, are feeling subpar relative to what they could if they dialed in everything. Now, for some people, it's less genetic, more lifestyle. For people that I work with that have sought me out, that have tried everything else, it's more genetic. But going back to the methylation side of aging, if you optimize the methylation process, no matter what, like you said, we're going to age, we're going to die, you know, no matter what. But you can dramatically... you can dramatically slow that methylation aspect of aging. Now, I'm not aware of longevity, honestly, isn't one of my super strong suits. But I'm sure I wonder if methylation stuff affects the telomerase shortening. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if it does. What nutrients are also required? What nutrient deficiencies promote telomerase degradation, if that makes sense? I'm sure if you're deficient in certain nutrients, the telomeres will shorten quicker, mm-hmm. aside from cell divisions. At least I could be wrong, but just intuitively thinking, I think that. So what if you had a genetic mutation that makes you not absorb that nutrient as well? And what if you give that nutrient? You know, you see kind of how my head approaches this. Yeah. I don't fucking know if that's the case, but I could read for a half hour and let you know if it's has some validity or not, you know? And then that's, again, how this idea hypothesis gets formed and, mm-hmm. you know.
Telomeres, for everyone listening, I probably should have mentioned this before, like the
oh yeah,
the aglet, the cap of your genes. And every time they replicate, generally they get shorter. There's some evidence that certain things can extend the length of the telomeres. They get longer. But what I was just going to say, I was like, you could also look at the other side too, right? It's like, maybe if we can figure out what nutrients the cells need to last longer so they don't need to replicate as much, then the telomeres won't need to short.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, it's a good way of thinking. Yeah. Yeah. I think of it as like a fuse on a bomb, basically. Each time it replicates, it gets a little shorter. And there's a limited number of replications that cells can undergo. One of the hallmarks of cancer is the cell can continue to replicate nonstop infinitely. And that's literally what a tumor is, just a mass of mutated cells that just won't stop growing. And I think it's also worth mentioning too, you know, just all of us having a finite lifespan, no matter how we cut it. That's why too, it's like I'll be the first to say like, yeah, like I go out and drink alcohol. And when I drink alcohol, I drink to get drunk. I personally definitely far from my favorite drug of choice by light years, but like, you know, I supplement properly to prevent myself from the, and I support myself to prevent any reactive oxygen species. So I'm rarely ever hungover. You know, if I'm at Costco and I see a snack, my wife and I want to have that as canola oil, I eat it. At the end of the day, it's all about pros versus cons. You know, I'm locked in to what makes me feel my best 90%+ of the time. And at the end of the day, we're all going to go eventually. So I've worked with people that are so petrified of everything. They're living in fear constantly. And the last thing I want to do is add to that fear. I have people that are like, I'm so worried that I'm going to die. I've had clients that try to cancel the consult after they paid for it, after I did all my work. They're so petrified about what they're going to find out. And I'm like, listen, all these mutations we're going to talk about, they're not one in a million. These are like 20, 30, 40, 50% of the population has them. So it's not like, it's not like, you know what I mean? They'll think it's some
silver
total doomsday sentence. Yeah. But I'm talking about things. I only talk about genes that we can do something about. I could talk to you for hours about all the mutations, what they mean, but I talk to you about the genes that have actionable steps. They're actionable mutations that we can hack around. Certain mutations and certain, like kind of like you mentioned for, you know, the magnesium transporter. If you have that mutation, at least we could add more magnesium. If you have mutation in some intermediate enzyme that like we can't really target at all, what's the use of wasting my time that you're paying me for to talk about if there's nothing we can do about it? Yeah. There's plenty of other stuff that we can actually take into our control and handle.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think a lot of people have issues, or like I foresee, I talk about this, I've written about this a little bit. One of my favorite articles was called What Does It Mean to Be Healthy? Because we all have this like, everyone thinks they're healthy. And like the definition is literally not disease. Like you don't have cancer. That doesn't mean you're healthy. And spending some sort of time, whether it's journaling or looking up or podcasts or whatever, on like what it means to be healthy and getting some sort of like sense of like, to at least to you, what it defines, I think is so important.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I would define it as waking up feeling good. I mean, I'll be totally honest. Like I have caffeine every day. I'll take a day off here or there, but now that I have the right supplements that also support my energy production, I have maybe 200, maybe 250 milligrams of caffeine first thing in the morning before I go and work out. I'm set the whole day, which really isn't that much. Caffeine does have good health benefits, but me waking up and not feeling like garbage, you know, I feel like I'm going to crush the day before my vitamins, breakfast and caffeine. No, not as much. I don't think that means you're necessarily not healthy, but I think being able to be active and move and be able to tackle intellectual challenges gracefully. Like we're all going to get stressed. You know, no one's perfect like that. I also think being able to be able to physically move and exert your body to a reasonable degree without significant levels of pain. And if you do have a negative emotion, not have that completely derail your day. Like I said, this week's been very stressful for me. So I have let that get the best of me. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm not healthy, but how many people are like, oh, I got to sit down after I ate. Oh, I whatever. Like I feel more tired or, I just have a headache. You just have a headache because of inflammation in your brain. Like that's not healthy to me. Like when do I get headaches? When I have high histamine. So that's why I could tell for me personally or gluten, I get that headache, but normally I don't. So, yeah, I mean, it means different things to everyone. What's it mean to you?
I mean, I think generally, I think like the healthy functioning cells is like a high, I think more it's something to work towards. So like, I feel like being healthy is probably something that like saying I should feel better is probably.
Well, that's a great way you put it. Like, cause me personally, it's been what, I don't know, like probably five years that I've really like, you know, really changed my life, getting my anxiety under control, under the understanding the genes, the histamine. Those are the two biggest changes for me personally. And each year I'm like, wow, this is the best I felt. Like I feel good pretty much all the time, et cetera. And then the next year I'm like, I feel even better. And it's just like, where's the ceiling here? You know? And like, ironically enough, I'm on the least amount of supplements I've been on because I found what really works for me. I mentioned C-Legit. That's one of my favorite supplements. I feel so amazing on that. You got to make sure you're getting high quality stuff, but like, I fucking love that stuff. I really do. And I think the only real issue for that is it's very high in iron. So people that are prone to high iron may want to be wary of that. But that replaced a lot of other supplements that I was taking and I just feel so much better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually took your recommendation and I've been taking Shilajit. And also you can pair it with coffee to help with iron chelation. But you have a link in your bio, right, for those recommendations for some links. Cool.
So yeah, absolutely. Check those
out. What do you look for in a high Shilajit or a quality Shilajit supplement?
So I always look for ones that have third-party testing. But the brand that I'm working with now, so there's two brands I have on my website, Pure Himalayan Shilajit, which I love. That was the first. I actually tried the pill version from the patented brand they use for the study. So it was a pill version. I took that for a while. I felt a little better, nothing crazy. Then I started taking the Pure Himalayan Shilajit, the resin. And I was like day one, 5 minutes in before my coffee, I was just like, wow. Like I had to cut my caffeine in half.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying. I'd much rather get all my minerals and support my body's natural energy production through something like Shilajit and need much less caffeine than be drinking all this caffeine. Mm-hmm. You should not need, I hear about people having like a gram of caffeine a day or like 500 milligrams of caffeine a day. And like you are inflamed, whether it's leaky gut, whether it's histamine, you're lacking micronutrients as well. Like there's no way you need all of that, assuming you're well rested. Obviously, if you didn't sleep or slept like dog shit, you could down caffeine. It's not really good. You're not going to feel it, you know, but on a normal day, that should not be what the norm is. And then I started working recently, this brand Nutritonic, and they use nano filters and do like an extended sun drying method. And that was even bigger of a boost. I actually had to cut my, I used to do 3 drops in the morning of the Shilajit. I had to cut back to 2 because I wouldn't get anxious. I would just be at my desk 9:30 at night, ready to work another 6 hours. Wow. And like, it's like, I got to go to bed. Like, it's like, I didn't feel bad at all. It's just an abundance of energy, an excess of energy is different than anxiety. You know, mm-hmm. It can be kind of blurred the lines between them. And sometimes I do one drop in the morning because it just gives me that much energy and I'll lower the caffeine, try to figure that out. Yeah, that made a huge change for me personally overall. And I recommend that people at least try that. I know I've seen some women do well with it for PCOS, hormone optimization. Some other women, the testosterone, it can raise too high, cause some issues. So always get blood work, see how you feel, talk to your doctor. Yeah, I love Shilajit. Awesome stuff.
Awesome. I have a million questions I could ask you, but I just want to have to ask this one. And I hope we've helped de-stress you a little bit. Hopefully this has been relaxing. But lithium supplementation, I've been so interested in it. I've heard you mention it because it makes so much sense to me because it's in the same ionic form or column, whatever, in the periodic table as sodium. So in my sense, it would make a lot of sense as like an electron conductor. Have you used it as like a nootropic? Or I know you've messed around with it, I believe.
Yeah, so I tried it myself and I noticed it. Similar to the Shilajit, it just gave me a little too much energy. So I still have some. I'm probably going to revisit it and try like removing the Shilajit. Like there's a couple, like Sammy's another one that like I can't do my multivitamin, Shilajit, Sammy. Plus it's just too much. It's just too much energy. And, but lithium is really, really fascinating. So many really interesting benefits. First off, it actually helps lower arachidonic acid levels in the brain. So that's that pro-inflammatory fatty acid that I mentioned earlier that's made from linoleic acid. And people can have genetic mutations where they have higher levels of arachidonic acid. So that may work for them. It also raises something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, to help grow new brain cells. It actually also helps detoxify aluminum out of the body. And it also helps the dopamine 2 receptor is responsible for motivation and reward. A lot of people that have addiction, gambling, anxiety, depression issues can have mutations where they produce less of this receptor. So there's less of the receptor on the cell surface. and lithium can actually help sensitize it. So it doesn't make you make more of it. Mm. It binds it on the side. Think of like a side pocket, like a hidden door, if you will, called an allosteric modulator, and it'll help sensitize that receptor. So if I see someone that has genetically high arachidonic acid levels, genetically low BDNF levels, genetically low dopamine 2 receptor, I'm like, wow, lithium literally fits the bill for like all of that. I think it could actually also, I believe it could speed up that COMT enzyme I mentioned. Okay. So it can help lower adrenaline. It actually also, it's fascinating, that like fascinating molecule. It also is a cofactor. It helps transport B12 through your blood inside of your cells.
Oh, that's crazy.
So I've worked with people that have mutations in I have this mutation as well, the gene that transports B12 through your blood inside of your cells. And this is why with blood work, I use blood work. I don't go crazy with it because it's measuring what's in the blood. Now it's in the cells. Mm. Like MTHFR, let's just say you can only activate 10% of the B12. That's the B12 that gets inside of your cells. So if you can't transport inside of your cells, I've had some people that don't really respond much to B vitamins. We add a little bit of lithium and they're lit up like a Christmas tree because now they're actually transporting it inside of their cells. So I have utilized that with clients. Usually it's not the first thing I utilize. I'll try just the multivitamin first with the proper B vitamins. Like, let's see how you do with just B vitamins first before we stuff them inside of your cells. You know what I mean? Like, it could be when I was first starting out, I kind of made that mistake sometimes with my first couple of clients, adding a multivitamin and SAMI or a multivitamin and lithium the first day. And then they messaged me. They're like, the past 2 days, I haven't really slept. I'm so overly wired. I'm like, okay. Now I learned, you know, you can do too much because any supplement or any supplement you start or any drug, you take it, you're here, you take it, you have that honeymoon phase where you're like, holy shit. And then it'll like wear off, it'll wear off like 20, 30%. Like you'll still be better than where you were, but that's like the honeymoon period. So sometimes you got to start certain energy boosting supplements, let it run through the honeymoon phase, see where you're at. If then you still want to try a little more energy, then we'll try adding another one. So that's one thing that I've changed throughout the past 8-9 months I've been doing this, especially with things that directly increase energy output, energy production, adrenaline production. Start with one at a time and stagger that over time. Sometimes people end up adding the lithium in, sometimes they don't. But really interesting you brought up lithium. I need to do a post about this. I haven't really talked about all these different mechanisms here, but it's really fascinating. And what's even more ironic is, the second I mentioned lithium, people's eyes are like, what?
Yeah.
Lithium. You know, and for you guys listening, lithium bicarbonate is the lithium that's used for psychiatric diseases, bipolar depression. Lithium orotate is an over-the-counter version. You need much less of a dose. They'll use 300 milligrams up to like a gram of the lithium bicarbonate. And a lot of the side effects come because due to that bicarbonate, you need a higher dosage. You need like 5 milligrams of lithium orotate. Like that's usually what they come in, over the counter. I've had people, clients that had depression that used to be on lithium and they stopped it. And we actually, based on the genes, you're like, oh no, lithium actually makes sense for you. They end up going on the lithium orotate and they're like, wow, this feels way better than the one they're currently using in conventional medicine. And that's not because necessarily a maliciousness. It's because they have to do the rigorous clinical trials to prove that it, you know what I mean? Like there's studies showing, there's clinical data showing it is safe for usage. It is safe to be used. So I'm not literally just pulling something out of the sky. You know, it's a product you can get anywhere. Everything I use with clients, you can get at a vitamin shop. You know, I'm just kind of pointing them in the right direction there. But lithium, super, super interesting. A lot of very, very interesting mechanisms. And kind of, if you think about this too, lithium can also have some interactions with the serotonin system as well. So if someone, I think it might, does it lower? I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. Do something with the serotonin. I'm trying to get a word of this. All those different mechanisms I mentioned, you know, one of them may not agree with you. So that's why you may try it and feel a little too groggy and out of it. And even though other genes say that it may not be for you, but that's why they're all just, you know, gentle suggestions to try out.
Yeah. Well, that was awesome. I wish I could keep you here forever, but I know you've got to run. Where can everyone find you?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram, at Dr. Tyler Panzner, P-A-N-Z-N-E-R, Z-N-E-R. That's my TikTok as well. Dr. Tyler Panzer on Facebook. My website is drnotylerpanzer.com. And I plan on getting on YouTube. I'm on LinkedIn as well, Tyler Panzer. I plan on getting on YouTube soon, taking the, I'm predominantly vast majority on Instagram. That's the main thing for me now, but I'm definitely planning on putting out more content soon, more consistently, because most of the stuff right now is just podcast snippets. But, you know, like we mentioned with the lithium, like more of these short form type things to get out there, because I don't hear a lot of people talking about, I don't hear anyone talking about a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, you know, and I think it's really important info. So thanks so much for having me on. Really hope everyone here learned something. You or you know someone that isn't happy where their health status is at. They want to try a new approach. They want to figure out, remove the guesswork, get rid of all those supplements you have that are sitting in your cabinet and figure out what actually works for you. Feel free to reach out. I'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thank you very much.